everyone. Thank you again so much for coming out for this last session. I promise to try to keep you awake for the next 15 minutes, as much as possible. So I don't have anything to disclose. So I want to give you a little bit of background about why religion and health are important. So in the literature, we see that religiosity is largely shown to be protective against sexual risk-taking, but there's still a lot of research that we can do around this because we don't really understand why or how or to what extent it is protective. Largely these measures around religion or spirituality are current and cross-sectional, so they kind of look at this point in time, do you identify as religious or spiritual? They don't really account for how your upbringing and how influences of religion over time can affect your beliefs and your behaviors, especially around sexual risk-taking. So there's more work that can be done there, and most of it is cross-sectional research as well. There's also a lot of more we could do in mixed methods and qualitative research. They're really getting the stories behind who's teaching you, why are they teaching you, what are they telling you, and which parts of it are more influential than others. And so that's kind of what my presentation is looking at today. And I'm going to be focusing solely on African American populations. That's really what our team does, but a lot of the literature shows that in African American populations in particular, religion is really important to them. The church is a credible source of information. It's something that is there for social support as well as teaching. It's very centralized and it's a place of trust. So it's a great venue to reach a lot of people at the same time. So first we wanted to look at the national perspective on what is the impact of religious upbringing on sexual risk taking and sexual education behaviors. So we did a cross-sectional national study. It was completely anonymous. We were looking at upbringing as well as risk-taking, their formation of social values, their stance on popular opinion issues such as comprehensive sex education, where should it be, who should teach you. You just had to be 18 years or older and living in the U.S. to participate. And we are currently still recruiting for this study, so shameless plug, if you, your organization is interested in helping us reach our goal, please come talk to me. So at the time of analysis when I did this, we had 1,280 responses, but I'm only including those that were complete because the religious upbringing section was last. So that included 851 responses, and I just selected out those who identified as African American. So I ended up with a total of 139 responses, which is pretty representative of the population in the U.S. in terms of ethnic identity. So the people who participated in this national study were largely female, with 121 females and only 17 males. Those of you who do this type of research might understand that it's a lot harder to get males to take these types of surveys, so I wasn't surprised by that. We did have a pretty good range of people in terms of age, so 18 all the way up to 66. Most people, median age was 39, largely heterosexual, largely educated, but in the 139 responses of African Americans, they represented 19 states coast to coast, so we had a pretty good view of the United States and weren't largely concentrated in one area. And for the religious demographics, it kind of paralleled what's in the literature. 73% of them grew up in the church or said that they grew up with some kind of religious influence. 76% of them had religious parents growing up, and then really surprised at the high number of people who were currently religious. So 93% said they currently identified with some spiritual or religious denomination. So did this predict anything? Because that's what's important. So we found that for African Americans in particular, growing up in the church was not predictive of anything. It didn't predict their beliefs or their behaviors, which is kind of interesting. But it kind of parallels recent literature that shows that growing up in a religious household or growing up in the church might be protective against your age of sexual debut, but after that your risk behaviors kind of equal out to those who grew up in non-religious homes. So That was interesting. But if you grew up with a religious parent, it was significantly associated with an age you were allowed to start dating and the first type of sexual activity you engaged in. But interestingly, it was not the first type of sexual activity we thought it would be. We had thought that they might engage in oral sex first, but we found that people who were religious were more likely to engage in vaginal sex first. Theory behind that might be that if it's already stigmatized to engage in sex before marriage, if you're gonna do it, just go for it. So not really sure the theory behind that. But if you are currently religious, it was significantly predictive of your beliefs, but not your behaviors, which is something that was mirrored in the qualitative study that I'm gonna talk about. So people who were currently religious were more likely to object to both teens and adults engaging in any type of behavior before sex. They were also more likely to favor abstinence only or abstinence plus education, as opposed to those who identified as non-religious almost all said that we should just do comprehensive sex education. So we kind of have this national look at what the data is on upbringing and sexual risk taking, and so we wanted to compare it with data that we have in the South. So maybe growing up in the South, in the Bible Belt, that kind of focuses more on religion, we'll have different findings. So we're currently conducting a study out of Atlanta. It's called the TEACH Program, Training and Empowering African American Churches on HIV. It's a three-year grant funded by the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, and it's actually a dissemination grant. So we're disseminating a program that we found to be effective from 2006 to 2011 called P4 for Women. It's a faith-based adaptation of the SISTA program. And as part of this program, all the church leaders, facilitators, and women who go through the program have the opportunity to participate in a qualitative interview. And they didn't have an incentive to participate in the interview, but they did have incentives to participate in the program as a whole. So basically, our staff created these toolkits, we gave it to the churches, and we were trying to get them to teach health education, comprehensive sex education. But we wanted to see how effective it was when they taught it instead of us teaching it. So we actually had a really great response for people participating in the qualitative interviews, and what we found is people want to talk about this. So of the 90 people that were enrolled when we started analyzing the data, 71 of them had participated in an interview. They represented 13 churches, largely female, largely the women who were going to be teaching the classes, so the facilitators. We did find that most of the time it was kind of seen as like a woman's job to kind of get involved with these programs. Not necessarily that the men weren't, they just weren't actively enrolled as part of the program, so they might provide oversight or have some type of influence. They just weren't part of the actively enrolled participants, so they didn't necessarily complete interviews. And the two church members, it's just because we've had delayed timelines. If you've ever worked with churches, getting on their calendar can be really, really difficult. So it's taken churches a lot longer than we originally predicted to actually implement this in their church and offer it as programming. So what we found from our interviews is that a lot of people did talk about the church having some type of role in what they thought about sex. What they thought about sex education. So you can see from the last one, I wasn't sexually active as a teen, and that is because of my parents' influence and, you know, the Bible's influence on me as well. So a lot of people talked about religion and religious upbringing as being something they got from the church and their parents, and it kind of overlaps a lot. They talked about it being a huge influence on their lives, what it meant, social movements, their social status. It meant everything. And what's kind of interesting is that people talk about it as a type of self-evaluation, that religion makes them think about their actions. But I'll talk about in a couple of slides, what's interesting is that it's kind of a reflection after you've already done something. So it's not necessarily preventing the first engagement in a risk behavior, but it's actually, I did it, now I'm thinking about my beliefs, and I don't want to do it again. So that was kind of something interesting that came out of this. And when you're looking at kind of the longitudinal effect of the church and religious upbringing, People talked a lot about stories and narratives of when they were growing up, what the church taught them about sexual risk-taking, that it is impacting them, but in a lot of ways, the way they go about it can be stigmatizing or judgmental because they often use people who are visibly pregnant or have visibly done something as an example. So this woman, who's actually an assistant pastor at one of the churches we're working at, said, "I would have to say that the teachings of the church impacted me greatly because these are the messages that I received ever since I was a child. Even growing up, when someone became pregnant, they would have to come before the church conference, they'd have to sit there, be embarrassed, and they would be asked not to come back to the church until after they had the baby. They would have to come back before the church and sort of be welcomed back. After, you know, they said, 'I'm sorry and I won't do it again.' But I've never seen them do this to the males. So this sort of, you know, was ingrained from me early on that you just don't do this." And that was something that came out a lot. Like, the women talked about how it's very stigmatizing for them, but nobody really ever talks about the males and their role in sexual risk taking too. So not sure if that's just because a large percentage of our respondents were female, and so that was their experience, but they talked about seeing it in their church that women were kind of taught to be abstinent, but not men, and that we should educate women, but not really the men. So the thing that I find most interesting that came out of these interviews is that almost everybody talked about do as I say, not as I did. So while people were fully supportive of us teaching sexual risk reduction, they themselves hadn't practiced any type of educational and practice safe sex. So they talked about how they had engaged in risky behaviors and often had negative consequences in their own life, but they wanted to keep telling everyone not to have sex and they thought it would work. So I had sex before I got married and I ended up getting pregnant, but no, the best way is abstinence. Or one of the reverends was talking about how, you know, as a little girl, we're taught we're supposed to not have sex. We're supposed to be abstinent. And I remember I used to really believe that. That was, of course, the older I got, that changed. And her daughter's now following in her footsteps. She's the same way. So a lot of people talked about how they personally had become pregnant. They had engaged in sexual risk. And because of their experiences, they wanted to talk to others about why they shouldn't do that. But it was interesting because even though they had experienced negative consequences because of the sexual risk behaviors they had engaged in, there was this disconnect between what the next generation should do. And that kind of goes to this idea of the Bible versus reality. But what's interesting is that people were very aware of what was going on in reality. So they understand that the church is saying one thing and people are doing something else in reality, and I was really surprised by how many people wanted to actually embrace reality and actually address the sexual risk that's going on in congregations. My favorite is this minister of HIV/AIDS, and he says, church folks stay and abstain, but they, the same folks pushing that mess, were screwing long before they were married. So his interview was quite interesting. But, you know, they talk about how, yes, our opinion is that we should not have premarital sex, but we understand people do that. It's better to be safe than to be sorry. So, you know, there is some stigma associated with that. You know, we say that you shouldn't have premarital sex, but when people don't exactly follow that, there's repercussions. Are we endorsing premarital sex if we teach comprehensive sex education? Are we telling them it's okay? And so a lot of people talk about how we need to erase the stigma that congregations are not at risk, this isn't going on in the church, so we should kind of embrace a more comprehensive sex education approach in the church. So the power of the pastor is really important in churches because they're the ones who have the influence to say what type of programming is going on. They were talked about, they had the pulse on the people in terms of they knew what was going on in the church, they knew what people were doing, they knew what they needed. So a lot of people talked about how we needed to have the buy-in of the pastor in order to do comprehensive sex education in the church. And so that's something to consider in doing programming in the future. And a lot of people talked about there's a need for it. Like, we need it, we need to do it in the church. I think it's a great place. And so that was really encouraging as a sexual health researcher to see people wanting to do this in this venue, to being open-minded about it. Some churches were already doing comprehensive sex education, and then other churches talked about, you know, we can't hide it anymore. People can't hide out in the church. We need to provide education. So basically, we came away with this understanding that comprehensive sex education is something that we can do. Just because you teach abstinence doesn't mean the majority are going to practice abstinence. So those who aren't practicing abstinence, they need to know what the other options are. And one of the first ladies was talking about how, yeah, I would love for the message to be abstinence in one partner, but it's not realistic. So we need to teach abstinence in one partner. We need to teach protection and responsibility. The individual has the right to choose. We should provide the information so people can make the healthy choice. So in conclusion, you know, from all the interviews we've done, these are kind of our takeaway messages for what we can do in the future. Start sex education early. Upbringing may influence its beliefs and delay debut, but risks are still prevalent. It's still going on, so we need to educate early. There is this disconnect between behaviors and beliefs, and that's why it's more important to do comprehensive sex education as opposed to abstinence-only education in the church. And churches want to do this, but they need the tools and support. So a lot of times they don't know where to start, they don't know who to connect with, who to collaborate with, they just don't know when to get started. So if we as practitioners can provide them with the resources to do that, they're very open-minded to incorporating it into their programming. The leadership is a key stakeholder. They're, you know, part of the key to breaking the cycle of stigma in these venues. And we need to focus on creating open dialogue so that we can change the false perception that sexual risk behaviors are not occurring at the church. And what we found from our interviews is that actually a lot of people who had engaged in risk themselves were very open to talking about it to serve as examples for others. So they would say, I did this and this is what happened to me, and they weren't afraid to talk about it. And so they want to serve as examples. And so we should kind of bring these people in from the community and engage them in these types of programs. So I just want to thank everyone from our team. We have two people here today who work on our team, Amory and Tiffany in the back. It takes a community to do this type of work. So thank you to everyone who worked on our team, has helped with coding all these interviews. And we'd like to acknowledge our funders. They fund the TEACH program, just that one study. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Danielle. I want to thank all of our speakers. So now we have a few minutes. I want to open the floor for questions. And so do we have any questions for any of the speakers? Okay, Anna Maria?
Yeah, I actually have a question for Jane. I was just curious about why the participants were screened out for their previous sexual history. What exactly?
Yeah, so because the intervention is testing behavioral change of those sexual risk factors, people had to have engaged in the sexual risk factor in the last 4 months to know if it's the intervention that hasn't changed, or they already are always using condoms, or always, you know, just engaging in sex with one partner or those things. So the intervention was that just the behavioral one. But that was, yeah, it was a challenge though, because the intervention obviously covers a lot of other issues that are relevant to people's lives, like housing and employment and, you know, how to negotiate with homophobic healthcare providers, things like that that were relevant to people regardless of sexual risk. And it was challenging to not be able to offer it to those people.
Okay, any other questions? I have a couple, but I want to get the audience questions first. Bethany.
Yes. So you talk about the 357 testers that went through this program. What was the positivity rate, and sort of what happened in terms of telehealth if the client tested positive?
That's a really good question. So first, I think the first question you asked is how many positives we have from the HIV test? Zero. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I mean, it's good, but at the same time, obviously the point of the program is to reach those individuals who we think are most at risk and catch them so we can provide them and connect them with services. So the fact that we haven't had any positive tests means that perhaps those are the healthy students that are more cognizant of knowing they should get tested, and we just haven't found our way yet to the risk students. In regards to telehealth, there's no formal connection between the testing of HIV and the alcohol counseling. So the two actually are sort of standalone programs that we encourage students, say, if they get HIV tested and our counselor identifies them as engaging in risky drinking, that we might refer them to telehealth. And then if in telehealth our substance abuse counselor might hear that they're engaging in risky sexual behavior, we'll refer them to perhaps get a rapid HIV test. But the two aren't formally linked. We're looking at sort of start version two after this grant is up to perhaps apply again for SAMHSA to see if we can meld the two together in a way that will help that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, this is something that when I ran out of time and I really wanted to talk about it, we actually had a technical assistant come from SAMHSA, and they recommended somebody to come, and I got all nervous, like, oh my God, we're doing something wrong, we need an assistant to come. And they said, actually, SAMHSA said that because we're doing telehealth, which is something they've never seen in that type of program, they wanted someone to come and provide assistance for us for improvements and then bring that information back to SAMHSA because they want to like learn from it too. And the trainer came and she was amazing and she pretty much said, create an environment of wellness among the students and promote it in that respect. So create more of the social norms that it's okay and it's healthy to talk about using alcohol because we're so stigmatized. Like we don't want somebody to feel like, oh, I have to go talk to a counselor about my alcohol use, as opposed to let's open up the discussion to it's healthy to talk about how we're using alcohol and maybe we can act as a conduit to connect with our friends and family that we recognize might actually be excessive users. So it's kind of like, let's open the floor, find people who then can locate us and refer us to other people, and that's what's starting to happen slowly, but not enough. So we think our next step in year three is to really open the door for a holistic wellness approach, and let's create more discussion about how healthy it is to talk about alcohol use, because that way we can find out more if people need our help and get help, and that's healthy, getting help. So we want to create more of like this wellness approach, yeah.
Great. Any other questions?
I have a question for Danielle. So you talked about how in your study you saw that there was only a difference between those that had permanent upbringing and those that didn't in their age of sexual debut, but there wasn't anything related to their current behavior. So I was just wondering if you happen to also measure their current rate of like STIs or like things like that, and further any differences you think there might be differences in risk of STIs with those with upbringing goals.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really learning on these different amounts of the religion and STI rate in college students. Mm-hmm. And so in the national survey, there wasn't any difference. We did a presentation in another conference about regional differences, and when you look at it based on regions, when you look at it from a national perspective, there's not. And that's what we call this too, but the paper that we're working on that's looking at religion and its effect on STI rate in college students in the South, and there is a difference. So those who identify as more religious have less STI rate and have reported in the last 12 months and in their lifetime have less diagnosed STI because they did a full panel. So that was kind of interesting. We're kind of looking at out of the perspective of can it be used to predict whether or not someone is going to have STI or not during lifetime. So I think it really depends on where you're looking. That's kind of what the trend has been in my recent experience is that when you look at it in the South, there's a lot of
okay, thank you so much. And Charles, I have a question for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about your recruitment strategies?
Sure. So the we worked with a large number of CBOs, community-based organizations, and those, one of our co-authors, Pam, is leader of the Cameron Medical Association. They were a key kind of collaborator with us, and they do a lot of peer education with sex workers, so they have their own kind of say, networks of contacts, and they would both invite them or suggest to us to have them be seats for the quantitative piece, and then also suggest folks to be participants in the qualitative piece as well.
Okay, and let's see, Danielle. Okay, you said, I think the first or second slide, you had 17 males.
Yes.
What were some of the comments from the males?
That was for the quantitative.
Oh, right, day, okay.
But, I mean, if you want to, we had 5 males that participated in the qualitative
okay.
study so far.
Uh-huh.
In terms of, like, is there anything in particular you're interested in knowing what they talked
about? Oh, just anything, or the one thing that struck me was the quote from the female pastor when someone got pregnant.
Yeah.
That definitely is true. Being a member of an African-American church, they would bring the person to the church. Just so traumatized. And I would just always say, but Mom, where is the guy?
Yeah.
You know, why isn't he coming up there? So those gender differences. And I was just wondering if the few males in the study, if you could got any type of indication from that.
Like, the males had much more conservative beliefs about what we should be teaching women, but they all 5 of them wanted us to bring a program in for the men.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of still this idea that we don't need to educate, like, women, we need to educate the men.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of stigma, the stigma is mostly focused on the women.
Yeah,
and it's usually
definitely.
Because they bear the physical signs.
Yeah.
And I had to cut out quotes. I was a little quote happy, and I was just like, oh my God, I don't put anything on the side.
Yeah.
But one woman in particular was talking about how it is stigmatizing because she was saying that, well, I can't tell if the person next to me has sex, but I sure can tell if they're pregnant. And so, like, that was kind of the idea. And another woman was talking about how she had gotten pregnant as a teen, and then her daughter got pregnant as a teen. She just told her daughter to not have sex because that's what her mother told her, but she recognized that didn't exactly work, and she was so disappointed, and she wouldn't let her daughter come back to church until she had the baby because she didn't want her to experience stigma. So I think there's a lot of gender differences that we need to talk about. I think there's a lot of education that needs to go into it. Like, people in the church are very open to education as long as it has some type of faith-based approach, and you know, they really want it to be able to be tailored to what they're teaching, what their religious doctrine is, but they're very open to it being comprehensive as long as absence is part of that, as long as we're not just, you know, saying condoms, as long as we're saying, you know, there's absence, there's monogamy, there's condom use, and they're open to it. I just don't think that they have the tools and resources they need to actually address that issue. So we're
very
kind of
good.
Stuck in this limbo of, like, there's still stigma, still gender differences. We don't have that education, but now we need to address, like, how do we move from that to actually incorporating that type of education.
And one final question for Jane. I wanted to see how you handled your recruitment and also the IRB.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do it, like, informed consenting? How did you handle that?
Oh yeah, so people consented when they came in for their baseline.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then as far as recruitment, it was just really anything and everything, like I said. So we, and a lot of us volunteered at organizations where we knew that we would be able to meet and kind of build rapport with young trans women. We also built relationships with organizations that would refer people to us. Like I said, our staff were out literally all hours of the day and night at out on the street, places where they knew that young women were likely to be engaged in sex work or meeting clients, at bars and events, and we did online recruitment. We did a lot of, like, referrals. We had this drawing of people refer a friend.
Did you do social media?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was getting to.
Okay.
Like, with the social media, how did you handle the IRB, because some institutional review boards, they have different protocols for if you're trying to recruit, say like on a Facebook or Twitter,
yeah.
But especially if it's identifiable information. Mm-hmm. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, we have really specific messages that were approved by the IRB,
okay.
And a specific kind of protocol for how to engage people, not to like post directly on people's walls.
That's it, yes.
But, you know, mm-hmm. doing private messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And we also tried some dating sites, which actually didn't work that well for us, but is very useful and popular among a lot of studies related to young men who have sex with men. For us, it's really hard to identify trans women on those dating sites because people are not necessarily out, so it's kind of hard to like find who is a trans woman.
Great.
So that didn't work so well for us, but we did also have approval to do that for our IRB, which was great because that, you know, we get a lot of
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming to this session today. And let's just give our panelists all a round of applause. Excellent job. Thank you very much.